Lainey Anderson, welcome to The Last Post magazine. You've been a journalist of some note over the years, and well, I remember reading your columns when I was living in Adelaide, so you've been doing some great work for a long time. You've got The Long Flight Home now, which is an amazing book with an amazing story, Lainey. It, I think this year marks the anniversary of the flight that actually was the world's first flight from England to Australia, which they've said was an achievement akin to man landing on the moon. Was it that big?
Hey, Greg, thank you very much for having me on the show. Actually, it was. Can you believe it? So I did a Churchill Fellowship back in 2017 to prove up almost to build a business case for an old plane that we've got sitting here at Adelaide Airport that's used to have pride of place out the front of the old terminal. But when the terminal moved in early, about 2006, the plane stayed in its original spot. And so we've sort of lost connection as a state to this incredible old plane. And so I went on a bit of a journey on a Churchill Fellowship to try and find out about the plane, to find out just how significant it is in terms of aviation history today, and how important that first flight was from England to Australia. And yeah, international historians, aviation historians, said that in its day it was like man landing on the moon. It basically set the scene for a whole era, a golden era of aviation exploration, all these incredible flights by the likes of Charles Lindbergh and Amelia Earhart, Amy Johnson, our own Charles Kingston Smith. So, and it turns out that the Vickers Vimy that we've got sitting here is one of the most important historical objects for aviation on the planet. And one of the curators at the Smithsonian in Washington said that it should be as iconic to Australia as the Spirit of St. Louis is to America, which is Charles Lindbergh's plane, of course. So just we've got some incredible aviation history here in Adelaide, and it's great that for the centenary year we're able to celebrate it.
Yeah, I think this is probably something that's been long overdue, and it was you that actually... What was the interest? What led you to have this interest in aviation? Did you always have it?
No, I have. I mean, I am so unmechanically minded. You know, I can barely open my car door. But so I've been writing a column in the Sunday Mail here for 12 years now. Mm-hmm. And in 2009, a Sunday Mail reader contacted me and said, "Lainey, I've just realised..." He'd been reading Peter Fitzsimons' book, Charles Kingston Smith and Those Magnificent Men. Mm-hmm. And he said, as a result of that, I ducked out to the airport because it mentioned the Vickers Vimy and our own Ross and Keith Smith, who flew it from England to Australia. Mm-hmm. And I've realised it's in the long-term car park now, and we've got to do something about it. Oh. And he said, "Could you please write a column?" And as soon as I started researching Ross Smith's life, I was just completely obsessed, and now I'm the crazy plane lady of South Australia.
Yeah, that's right. Indeed. And the crazy, maybe not so crazy, this would have been, I guess... to think Ross Smith and the crew with Keith and Wally and who was the other chap?
Jim
Bennett. That's right. Yeah,
from Victoria.
Yeah, the idea of that long term car park.
I know, and I think it's fantastic because just before the federal election, we got a funding commitment from the federal, state government, and also Adelaide Airport Limited to move the plane into the new terminal, which is just an incredible legacy of this centenary year, and also the result of lots of hard work from lots of different people we've been lobbying over the years. And I mean, some people have been lobbying for decades for greater awareness, you know, the guys down at the Aviation Museum and different RSL clubs and things. So I certainly can't claim the credit for moving the plane, but I mean, it's such a fantastic achievement. It's great.
Well, it's been a really community-minded thing too, I guess.
Yeah, it really has, yeah. And I mean, I think that's my very first column back in 2009. That's what sort of started it all, because for me, I mean, my own journey, because I was inundated from readers with letters and emails just saying, oh, I remember the Vimy, and oh, it's so fantastic that you're writing about it, and keep going. And then someone said, get a Churchill Fellowship, and then someone said, do a book, and then someone said, how about you do a documentary? And I always do what I'm told, Greg, so I've done it all now.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll have to take a leaf out of your book. That's so incredible. The journey itself, with Ross and Keith and Jim and Wally, the plan itself was just wood fabric and I guess and wire was put together, and of course, 18,000 kilometres, nearly unthinkable today that they only had a compass to guide them.
I know, and I mean, you look at the plane, it's huge. I mean, it's a lot bigger than most people think. You can basically fit two buses underneath each of the biplane wings.
Mm.
But, it sort of looks a bit like a very big, long coffin, the fuselage.
Mm.
And to think that they had open cockpits, basically only a plane for navigation, and there were really no airfields after India. So the fact that six teams, the Vimy crew is one of six Australian crews that set out from London in 1919 to try and become the first. I think it shows just how dangerous it was, the fact that two of those crews did die.
Mm.
Two others crashed out, and it was only the Vimy that made it home in the required 30 days to win the £10,000 prize that had been put up by the Australian government. So, I mean, this was an incredibly risky venture.
Yeah.
And newspapers at the time and different political leaders warned against it as an endeavour, because it was only 16 years after the Wright brothers.
Yeah.
Made the first man-powered flight. So it was incredibly audacious.
You put that into perspective, Lainey, and when you say 16 years after the Wright brothers, then you look at the distance travelled. What an encapsulating moment.
And the fact that, you know, because there were no airfields, these guys were landing on jungle clearings or on tiny racetracks, and this was a really huge, cumbersome... I mean... It was basically actually state-of-the-art, to be fair,
in its day.
It was a second-generation bomber. But the racetracks that they had to land on in Rangoon, by modern-day Yangon in Myanmar, and, like, Singapore, were so tiny. At one stage, Jim Bennett actually climbed out of the aft cockpit as they were landing in Singapore and slid down to the tail wing to bring the plane up really quickly as they were landing. They fixed in Cairo, they fixed a cracked induction pipe with chewing gum, because they couldn't bring a spare Rolls-Royce engine with them.
They had chewing gum.
Wrigley's were really clever, savvy marketers, and they gave all of the crews, just as they'd been giving soldiers gum all throughout the war, they gave each of the crews a little box of gum. Just amazing stories of endeavour and courage and ingenuity, really, you know.
Well, I see, Lainey, very much the next step for you may be to write a screenplay or a treatment of this story. They can turn this into a movie.
Well, I'll tell you a secret. I have actually sent it to Peter Jackson, because, you know, he's a huge aviation fan, and he's got the aviation museum over in Wellington.
Yes.
So I've sent it to him, and in the front I wrote, thought this might be right up your alley, Peter, and then I put my phone number and email address. So if Peter Jackson happens to be listening to the podcast, I'd love, you know, him to...
Well, he may be doing so. He may be doing so. You know why? Because I had some dealings with his PA in New Zealand, Lainey. So there's a chance of that, because I want to interview Peter, and he said this looks right up his alley, just using your words, exactly the same.
Right.
So there may be some connection there, and if that happens, we'll see. Yeah.
And he has in his museum, he actually has a little model of a Vickers Vimy plane, and there are only two surviving original Vickers Vimys in the world, and we've got one, and the other is Alcock and Brown's Vimy in the Science Museum, which... like, by the way, is seen by 3 million people every year.
Yes.
So that's why it's so fantastic that ours is going to be moved into the new terminal, where it can be seen by millions of people too.
This is it all comes together brilliantly. Of course, I suppose we look back at a sometimes maligned figure, Billy Hughes, and I guess in many ways it wouldn't have happened without Billy, his idea.
Well, yeah, and he is a really central character to this, because he had met with aviators who were hospitalised. So, I mean, incredibly dangerous. The guys who flew in the First World War actually had a higher casualty rates than guys in the trenches. Mm. And at some stages during the war, they had a 2-week life expectancy on the Western Front. So Billy Hughes had met with some injured Australian aviators, and then for the peace talks in Paris, he began flying for the very first time between England and Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And it was then that he realised that in peacetime, aviation had the potential to bring his young nation, Australia, closer to the mother country.
Mm-hmm.
And he was... I mean, I know, yes, he does have a varied sort of legacy in terms of whether people loved him or hated him. I think he was a bit of a polarising character, but he was determined to ensure that the sacrifice of those 60,000 young Australians in the war wasn't in vain. And this was one of the ways that he thought he could make sure, you know, that Australia stayed on the world stage, which he believed it deserved to after the sacrifice of so many young men.
Yes, he did go incredible. And then I guess how much was it? 10,000 pounds or something, wasn't it?
It was 10,000 pounds, and when they reached Darwin in 27 days and 20 hours.
Wow.
And then, funnily enough, it took them 3 months to do their victory lap of Australia because the Rolls-Royce engines basically said, nah, had it, not going any further. And they needed to have a complete overhaul over in Queensland.
Mm.
They managed to sort of limp over there, basically, and then they were stalled there for quite some time. But when they got down to Melbourne, which was the federal seat of parliament then,
mm-hmm.
Billy Hughes handed over the £10,000 cheque and they immediately split it four ways. And Wally Shires, to show just how much it was worth in those days, Wally Shires was able to buy a house in Sydney and a little business. He bought a garage. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
wow. Now,
I mean, you couldn't do that in £2,500 today.
No, that's quite incredible. And now you talk about Wally. He was going to buy some apricot trees or something. He wanted to be, he wanted to stay away from the war, but got drafted. How did you get into the head of Wally? Because it's a great story.
Yeah, well, when I was doing my Churchill research, I learnt that Wally was engaged to a girl in Naranja in country New South Wales before the war.
Helena.
And that's why I decided... Well, that's sort of because I'm a journo, my natural instinct was to try and write it as non-fiction. But of course, there are fantastic books on this from way back in 1969 that were written for the 50th anniversary that are non-fiction. And so I didn't really want to just, use that format again. So when I realised that Wally was engaged, it was the perfect vehicle to actually tell his story and to bring in Helena, his sweetheart before the war, bring in their story as well as Wally's incredible adventure, and also to show a man like Ross Smith through the eyes of someone else, like an everyman that we can all relate to, because we can all relate to Wally. He was like shorter than Charlie Chaplin. He wasn't scared of going to war, but it was just that his life was taking off. You know, he met this gorgeous girl. He'd become an electrician. He was, on a good wicket. He'd got himself a motorbike.
You've described Wally very well. You've described him very well too, because, Lainey, I mean, I was sort of really taken with the guy, and then when he said how short he was, and then I saw a photo of the forum outside the Vickers Vimy, and I immediately looked for the shortest guy. I said, that's Wally.
yeah, that's Wally. Yeah.
And he didn't want to go to war because he had all this thing. He, as you say, he had things set up and life was looking very good for him.
Yeah, that's right. So, but I mean, when he was, and he actually later in life in the 60s, so only a few years before he died, he actually gave a fantastic interview to an oral historian by the name of Hazel de Burgh.
Mm-hmm.
And you can listen to Wally off the National Library of Australia website. So, I have to admit, I have never done that because once I realised I wanted to write the book as Wally, I didn't actually want his own voice in my head because I needed to create my own sort of Wally in a fictional sense.
Yep.
So, but people can do that, and that's reading the transcript is where I learnt, because he actually tells the story of going to Sydney to buy some orange trees
mm-hmm.
from Naranja, thinking he was buying orange juice, going back to Helena, and getting stopped by this massive Sydney copper.
7 foot tall.
On the shoulder. Yes, tapped him on the shoulder and showed him a postcard of Kitchener saying, "We want you." So that's how Wally's life sort of changed and led to him going away. He went away with the Light Horse, then, like Ross Smith, joined the Flying Corps in Egypt and fought in Palestine, and then, yeah, went on this amazing adventure and, you know, became one of the first men to fly from England to Australia. And he was just this incredibly average, young, ordinary man who did an extraordinary thing, which I think everybody can sort of relate to.
And then,
you can really empathise with Wally and his choices and how he worried, and he was this lovely young worrying sort of, you know, was he making the right decisions? And
well, when when he got back to the Alfred's place, Helena and Mother's place, it changed. Everything changed so dramatically because it's well written. He comes back from the city, and you imagine that, you know, he had been denying the need to go to war, and the next thing you know, he said he signed up, and it was heartbreaking, really.
Oh, if you can imagine, and I mean, it was only August. It was only the August that of 14 that the war was announced, declared, and he enlisted in April 1915. So, you know, it wasn't like he was abstaining or anything like that. But I mean, you go away and your sweetheart thinks you've going to buy fruit trees for a block where you're going to build a house and get married, and the next minute, you know, he's telling her he's going away, and oh look, but how about we get engaged, because then you can, you know, be on my book and get the widow's pension if I die. And you can imagine what Helena must have been thinking.
He was being thoughtful while being thoughtless. Yeah, I just then the cheeky bugger saying he's going to ask her to marry him when he takes off on the train to Sydney. Quite incredible story. And then, of course, Wally meets the extraordinary himself, Ross Smith.
Yeah, and this was really interesting too, because I wanted people to just get to know Ross as, you know, just another soldier, as an airman, as well as, you know, through the eyes of someone who clearly idolised him, you know, put him up on a pedestal, and you sort of get swept away almost, you know, with a bromance. And, you know, that there's the tension that starts to emerge within Helena's letters about, you know, you can tell she's a bit jealous about this new central character in Wally's life.
Yes, yes, indeed.
And he's also grappling with his guilt, of course, that he's got his own brothers on the Western Front and also Helena's brother, who all in real life went across to the Western Front and saw horrific things, and indeed one of Wally's brothers died. And to be grappling with that guilt, which I'm sure some men, particularly men like Wally, who when you were a mechanic in the particularly on the Eastern Front in Cairo and Egypt and Palestine, you were actually quite a long way back from the front line.
You so need to be. That's you, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you lived. So you were actually quite well protected. So to hear the stories of what was going on the Western Front with your mates and your brothers, he would have been grappling with that. And then, of course, he also had Helena sort of, you know, when do you think you'll be able to come home? Will you come home as soon as, you know, if the war ends, will you come straight home to me? And then he lets her down again by saying, heading off with Ross.
He'd become a serial letter downer at this stage, because he just broke her heart again, you know?
I know, and of course... doing the right thing, because he wants to have a better life, you know, for himself and Helena. But of course, if you're sitting home and you've been making a wedding dress by hand for the last, you know, 3 years while he's been away at war, and you've gone to book the church knowing that the armistice has been declared, and then you get the letter to say, oh, by the way, I might be another year yet. It's like,
Did I tell you? That's right. Well, look, it's a magnificent story, Lainey. Absolutely magnificent. I think I'd recommend it to be read by just about everyone as a part of Australian history. And you've been part of that history now, which will be perpetual. The Long Flight Home by Lainey Anderson, it's a damn good read. And it's a fantastic story. Fact and fiction have been merged. It's just beautifully done. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me on, and thank you for your beautiful words. I'm just getting the most wonderful feedback about it.
I love good writing, Lainey. I love good writing. You're beautiful in that sense. So that's wonderful, and we do appreciate it so much. And it's shining a light on something that had been hidden in the dark for too long, perhaps.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate you having me on. You're helping to shine a light on it too, Greg. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Lainey, for being part of it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.